Grenouille had set down the bottle, removing his perfume-moistened hand from its neck and wiping it on his shirt tail. One, two steps back, and the clumsy way he hunched his body together under Baldini's tirade sent enough waves rolling out into the room to spread the newly created scent in all directions. Nothing more was needed. True, Baldini ranted on, railed and cursed, but with every breath his outward show of rage found less and less inner nourishment. He sensed he had been proved wrong, which was why his peroration could only soar to empty pathos. And when he fell silent, had been silent for a good while, he had no need of Grenouille's remark, "It's all done." He knew that already. But nevertheless, although in the meantime air heavy with amour and psyche was undulating all about him, he stepped up to the old oak table to make his test. He pulled a fresh, snowy white lace handkerchief from his coat pocket, the left one, unfolded it and sprinkled it with a few drops that he extracted from the mixing bottle with the long pipette. He waved the handkerchief with outstretched arm to aerate it, and then pulled it past his nose with the delicate, well-practiced motion, soaking up its scent. Letting it out again in little puffs, he sat down on a stool. Where before his face had been bright red with erupting anger, all at once he had grown pale.
"Incredible," he murmured softly to himself. "By God, incredible."
It was amour and psyche, beyond the shadow of a doubt, amour and psyche, that despicable, ingenious blend of scents, so exactly copied that not even Pélissier himself would have been able to distinguish it from his own product.
"Incredible."
Small and ashen, the great Baldini sat on his stool, looking ridiculous with handkerchief in hand, pressing it to his nose like an old maid with the sniffles. By now he was totally speechless. He didn't even say "incredible" any more, but nodding gently and staring at the contents of the mixing bottle, could only let out a monotone, After a while Grenouille approached, stepping up to the table soundlessly as a shadow.
"It's not a very good perfume," he said. "It's been put together very bad, this perfume has."
said Baldini, and Grenouille continued, "If you'll let me, maître, I'll make it better. Give me a minute and I'll make a proper perfume out of it." said Baldini, and nodded. Not in consent, but because he was in such a helplessly apathetic condition that he would have said, and nodded to anything. And he went on nodding and murmuring, and made no effort to interfere as Grenouille began to mix away a second time, pouring the alcohol from the demijohn into the mixing bottle a second time, right on top of the perfume already in it, tipping the contents of flacons a second time in apparently random order and quantity into the funnel. Only at the end of the procedure, Grenouille did not shake the bottle this time, but swirled it about gently like a brandy glass, perhaps in deference to Baldini's delicacy, perhaps because the contents seemed more precious to him this time. Only then, as the liquid whirled about in the bottle, did Baldini awaken from his numbed state and stand up, the handkerchief still pressed to his nose, of course, as if he were arming himself against yet another attack upon his most private self.
"It's all done, maître," Grenouille said. "Now it's a really good scent." "Yes, yes, fine, fine," Baldini replied, and waved him off with his free hand. "Don't you want to test it?" Grenouille gurgled on. "Don't you want to, maître? Aren't you going to test it?"
"Later. I'm not in the mood to test it at the moment. Have other things on my mind. Go now. Come on."
And he picked up one of the candlesticks and passed through the door into the shop. Grenouille followed him. They entered the narrow hallway that led to the servants' entrance. The old man shuffled up to the doorway, pulled back the bolt, and opened the door. He stepped aside to let the lad out.
"Can't I come to work for you, maître? Can't I?" Grenouille asked,
standing on the threshold, hunched over again, the lurking look returning to his eye.
"I don't know," said Baldini. "I shall think about it. Go."
And then Grenouille had vanished, gone in a split second, swallowed up by the darkness. Baldini stood there and stared into the night. In his right hand he held the candlestick, in his left the handkerchief, like someone with a nosebleed. But in fact he was simply frightened. He quickly bolted the door. Then he took the protective handkerchief from his face, shoved it into his pocket, and walked back through the shop to his laboratory. The scent was so heavenly fine that tears welled into Baldini's eyes. He did not have to test it. He simply stood at the table in front of the mixing bottle and breathed. The perfume was glorious. It was to Amor and Psyche as a symphony is to the scratching of a lonely violin. And it was more. Baldini closed his eyes and watched as the most sublime memories were awakened within him. He saw himself as a young man walking through the evening gardens of Naples. He saw himself lying in the arms of a woman with dark curly hair, and saw the silhouette of a bouquet of roses on the windowsill as the night wind passed by. He heard the random song of birds and the distant music from a harbour tavern. He heard whisperings at his ear. He heard, "I love you," and felt his hair ruffle with bliss, now, now, at this very moment. He forced open his eyes and groaned with pleasure. This perfume was not like any perfume known before. It was not a scent that made things smell better, not some sachet, some toiletry. It was something completely new, capable of creating a whole world, a magical, rich world, and in an instant you forgot all the loathsomeness around you, and felt so rich, so at ease, so free, so fine. The hairs that had ruffled up on Baldini's arm fell back again, and a befuddling peace took possession of his soul. He picked up the leather, the goat leather lying at the table's edge, and a knife, and trimmed away. Then he laid the pieces in the glass basin and poured the new perfume over them. He fixed a pane of glass over the basin, divided the rest of the perfume between two small bottles, applied labels to them, and wrote the words Nuit Napolitaine on them. Then he extinguished the candles and left. Once upstairs, he said nothing to his wife while they ate. Above all, he said nothing about the solemn decision he had arrived at that afternoon. And his wife said nothing either, for she noticed that he was in good spirits, and that was enough for her. Nor did he walk over to Notre Dame to thank God for his strength of character. Indeed, that night he forgot, for the first time ever, to say his evening prayers. 16. The next morning he went straight to Grimal. First he paid for his goat leather, paid in full, without a grumble or the least bit of haggling, and then he invited Grimal to the Tour d'Argent for a bottle of white wine, and negotiations concerning the purchase of Grenouille, his apprentice. It goes without saying that he did not reveal to him the whys and wherefores of this purchase. He told some story about how he had a large order for scented leather, and to fill it he needed unskilled help. He required a lad of few needs, who would do simple tasks, cutting leather, and so forth. He ordered another bottle of wine, and offered 20 livres as recompense for the inconvenience the loss of Grenouille would cause Grimal. 20 livres was an enormous sum. Grimal immediately took him up on it. They walked to the tannery, where, strangely enough, Grenouille was waiting with his bundle already packed. Baldini paid the 20 livres, and took him along at once, well aware that he had just made the best deal of his life. Grimal, who for his part was convinced that he had just made the best deal of his life, returned to the Tour d'Argent, there drank 2 more bottles of wine, moved over to the Lion d'Or on the other bank around noon, and got so rip-roaring drunk there that when he decided to go back to the Tour d'Argent late that night, he got the Rue Geoffroy-Lanier confused with the Rue des Nonindières, and instead of coming out directly onto the Pont Marie, as he had intended, he was brought by ill fortune to the Quai des Ormes, where he splashed lengthwise and face first into the water like a soft mattress. He was dead in an instant. The river, however, needed considerable time to drag him out from the shallows, past the barges moored there, into the stronger main current, and not until the early morning hours did Grimal the Tanner, or better, his soaked carcass, float briskly downriver toward the west. As he passed the Pont au Change, soundlessly, without bumping against the bridge piers, 60 feet directly overhead, Jean-Baptiste Grenouille was going to bed. A bunk had been set up for him in a back corner of Baldini's laboratory, and he was now about to take possession of it, while his former employer floated down the cold Seine, all four limbs extended. Grenouille rolled himself up into a little ball like a tick. As he fell off to sleep, he sank deeper and deeper into himself, leading the triumphant entry into his innermost fortress, where he dreamed of an odoriferous victory banquet, a gigantic orgy with clouds of incense and fogs of myrrh, held in his own honour. 17. With the acquisition of Grenouille, the house of Giuseppe Baldini began its ascent to national, indeed European, renown. The Persian chimes never stopped ringing, the herons never stopped spewing in the shop on the Pont au Change. The very first evening, Grenouille had to prepare a large demijohn full of Nuit Napolitaine, of which over 80 flacons were sold in the course of the next day. The fame of the scent spread like wildfire. Chénier's eyes grew glassy from the monies paid, and his back ached from all the deep bows he had to make, for only persons of high, indeed highest rank, or at least the servants of persons of high and highest rank, appeared. One day the door was flung back so hard it rattled. In stepped the footman of Count d'Argenson, and shouted, as only footmen can shout, that he wanted 5 bottles of this new scent. Chénier was still shaking with awe 15 minutes later, for Count d'Argenson was commissary and war minister to His Majesty, and the most powerful man in Paris. While Chénier was subjected to the onslaught of customers in the shop, Baldini had shut himself up in his laboratory with his new apprentice. He justified this state of affairs to Chénier with a fantastic theory that he called division of labour and increased productivity. For years, he explained, he had patiently watched while Pélissier and his ilk, despisers of the ancient craft all, had enticed his customers away and made a shambles of his business. His forbearance was now at an end. He was accepting their challenge and striking back at these cheeky parvenus, and what was more, with their own weapons. Every season, every month, if necessary every week, he would play trumps, a new perfume. And what perfumes they would be! He would draw fully upon his creative talents, and for that it was necessary that he, assisted only by an unskilled helper, would be solely and exclusively responsible for the production of scents, while Chénier would devote himself exclusively to their sale. By using such modern methods, they would open a new chapter in the history of perfumery, sweeping aside their competitors, and growing incomparably rich. Yes, he had consciously and explicitly said they, because he intended to allow his old and trusted journeymen to share a given percentage of these incomparable riches. Only a few days before, Chénier would have regarded such talk as a sign of his master's incipient senility. "Ready for the charité," he would have thought. "It won't be long now before he lays down the pestle for good." But now he was not thinking at all. He didn't get around to it. He simply had too much to do. He had so much to do that come evening he was so exhausted he could hardly empty out the cash box and siphon off his cut. Not in his wildest dreams would he have doubted that things were not on the up and up, though Baldini emerged from his laboratory almost daily with some new scent. And what scents they were! Not just perfumes of high, indeed highest quality, but also creams and powders, Soaps, hair tonics, toilet waters, oils. Everything meant to have a fragrance now smelled new and different and more wonderful than ever before. And as if bewitched, the public pounced upon everything, absolutely everything, even the newfangled scented hair ribbons that Baldini created one day on a curious whim. And price was no object. Everything that Baldini produced was a success, and the successes were so overwhelming that Chenier accepted them as natural phenomena and did not seek out their cause. That perhaps the new apprentice, that awkward gnome, who was housed like a dog in the laboratory, and whom one saw sometimes when the master stepped out, standing in the background, wiping off glasses and cleaning mortars, that this cipher of a man might be implicated in the fabulous blossoming of their business, Chenier would not have believed had he been told it. Naturally, the gnome had everything to do with it. Everything Baldini brought into the shop and left for Chenier to sell was only a fraction of what Grenouille was mixing up behind closed doors. Baldini couldn't smell fast enough to keep up with him. At times he was truly tormented by having to choose among the glories that Grenouille produced. This sorcerer's apprentice could have provided recipes for all the perfumers of France without once repeating himself, without once producing something of inferior or even average quality. As a matter of fact, he could not have provided them with recipes, that is to say, formulas, for at first Grenouille still composed his scents in the totally chaotic and unprofessional manner familiar to Baldini, mixing his ingredients impromptu and in apparent wild confusion. Unable to control the crazy business, but hoping at least to get some notion of it, Baldini demanded one day that Grenouille use scales, measuring glasses, and the pipette when preparing his mixtures, even though he considered them unnecessary. Further, he was to get used to regarding the alcohol not as another fragrance, but as a solvent to be added at the end. And for God's sake, he would simply have to go about things more slowly, at an easier and slower pace, as befitted a craftsman. Grenouille did it. And for the first time Baldini was able to follow and document the individual manoeuvres of this wizard. Paper and pen in hand, constantly urging a slower pace, he sat next to Grenouille and jotted down how many drams of this, how many level measures of that, how many drops of some other ingredient wandered into the mixing bottles. This was a curious after-the-fact method for analysing a procedure. It employed principles whose very absence ought to have totally precluded the procedure to begin with. But by employing this method, Baldini finally managed to obtain such synthetic formulas. How it was that Grenouille could mix his perfumes without the formulas was still a puzzle, or better, a miracle, to Baldini, but at least he had captured this miracle in a formula, satisfying in part his thirst for rules and order, and preventing the total collapse of his perfumer's universe. In due time he ferreted out the recipes for all the perfumes Grenouille had thus far invented, and finally he forbade him to create new scents unless he, Baldini, was present with pen and paper to observe the process with Argus eyes, and to document it step by step. In his fastidious, prickly hand, he copied his notes, soon consisting of dozens of formulas, into two different little books. One he locked in his fireproof safe, and the other he always carried with him, even sleeping with it at night. That reassured him, for now, should he wish, he could himself perform Grenouille's miracles, which had on first encounter so profoundly shaken him. He believed that by collecting these written formulas, he could exorcise the terrible creative chaos erupting from his apprentice. Also, the fact that he no longer merely stood there, staring stupidly, but was able to participate in the creative process by observing and recording it, had a soothing effect on Baldini, and strengthened his self-confidence. After a while, he even came to believe that he made a not insignificant contribution to the success of these sublime scents. And when he had once entered them in his little books and entrusted them to his safe and his bosom, he no longer doubted that they were now his and his alone. But Grenouille, too, profited from the disciplined procedures Baldini had forced upon him. He was not dependent on them himself. He never had to look up an old formula to reconstruct a perfume weeks or months later, for he never forgot an odour. But by using the obligatory measuring glasses and scales, he learned the language of perfumery, and he sensed instinctively that the knowledge of this language could be of service to him. After a few weeks, Grenouille had mastered not only the names of all the odours in Baldini's laboratory, but he was also able to record the formulas for his perfumes on his own, and, vice versa, to convert other people's formulas and instructions into perfumes and other scented products. And not merely that. Once he had learned to express his fragrant ideas in drops and drams, he no longer even needed the intermediate step of experimentation. When Baldini assigned him a new scent, whether for a handkerchief cologne, a sachet, or a face paint, Grenouille no longer reached for flacons and powders, but instead simply sat himself down at the table and wrote the formula straight out. He had learned to extend the journey from his mental notion of a scent to the finished perfume by way of writing down the formula. For him, it was a detour. In the world's eyes, that is, in Baldini's, it was progress. Grenouille's miracles remained the same. But the recipes he now supplied, along with them, removed the terror, and that was for the best. The more Grenouille mastered the tricks and tools of the trade, the better he was able to express himself in the conventional language of perfumery, and the less his master feared and suspected him. While still regarding him as a person with exceptional olfactory gifts, Baldini no longer considered him a second Frangipani, or worse, some weird wizard, and that was fine with Grenouille. The regulations of the craft functioned as a welcome disguise. He virtually lulled Baldini to sleep with his exemplary procedures, weighing ingredients, swirling the mixing bottles, sprinkling the test handkerchief. He could shake it out almost as delicately, pass it beneath his nose almost as elegantly as his master. And from time to time, at well-spaced intervals, he would make mistakes that could not fail to capture Baldini's notice, forgetting to filter, setting the scales wrong, fixing the percentage of ambergris tincture in the formula ridiculously high, and took his scoldings for the mistakes, correcting them then most conscientiously. Thus he managed to lull Baldini into the illusion that ultimately this was all perfectly normal. He was not out to cheat the old man, after all. He truly wanted to learn from him. Not how to mix perfumes, not how to compose a scent correctly, not that, of course. In that sphere, there was no one in the world who could have taught him anything, nor would the ingredients available in Baldini's shop have even begun to suffice for his notions about how to realize a truly great perfume. The scents that he could create at Baldini's were playthings compared with those he carried within him and that he intended to create one day. But for that, he knew, two indispensable prerequisites must be met. The first was the cloak of middle-class respectability, the status of a journeyman at the least, under the protection of which he could indulge his true passions and follow his true goals unimpeded. The second was the knowledge of the craft itself, the way in which scents were produced, isolated, concentrated, preserved, and thus first made available for higher ends. For Grenouille did indeed possess the best nose in the world, both analytical and visionary, but he did not yet have the ability to make those scents realities. 18. And so he gladly let himself be instructed in the arts of making soap from lard, sewing gloves of chamois, mixing powders from wheat flour and almond bran and pulverized violet roots, rolled scented candles made of charcoal, saltpeter, and sandalwood chips, pressed oriental pastilles of myrrh, benzoin, and powdered amber, kneaded frankincense, shellac, vetiver, and cinnamon into balls of incense, sifted and spatulated poudre impériale out of crushed rose petals, lavender flowers, cascarilla bark, stirred face paints, whites and vein blues, and moulded greasy sticks of carmine for the lips, banqueted on the finest fingernail dusts and minty-tasting tooth powders, mixed liquids for curling periwigs and wart drops for corns, bleaches to remove freckles from the complexion and nightshade extract for the eyes, Spanish fly for the gentlemen, and hygienic vinegars for the ladies. Grenouille learned to produce all such eau and powders, toilet and beauty preparations, plus teas and herbal blends, liqueurs, marinades and such. In short, he learned with no particular interest, but without complaint and with success, everything that Baldini knew to teach him from his great store of traditional lore. He was an especially eager pupil, however, when Baldini instructed him in the production of tinctures, extracts, and essences. He was indefatigable when it came to crushing bitter almond seeds in the screw press, or mashing musk pods, or mincing dollops of grey, greasy ambergris with a chopping knife, or grating violet roots and digesting the shavings in the finest alcohol. He learned how to use a separatory funnel that could draw off the purest oil of crushed lemon rinds from the milky dregs. He learned to dry herbs and flowers on grates placed in warm, shady spots, and to preserve what was once rustling foliage in wax-sealed crocks and caskets. He learned the art of rinsing pomades and producing, filtering, concentrating, clarifying, and rectifying infusions. To be sure, Baldini's laboratory was not a proper place for fabricating floral or herbal oils on a grand scale. It would have been hard to find sufficient quantities of fresh plants in Paris for that. But from time to time, when they could get cheap fresh rosemary, sage, mint, or anise seeds at the market, or a shipment of valerian roots, caraway seeds, nutmegs, or dried clove blossoms had come in, then the alchemist in Baldini would stir, and he would bring out the large alembic, a copper distilling vessel, atop it a head for condensing liquids, a so-called Moore's head alembic, he proudly announced, which he had used 40 years before for distilling lavender out on the open southern exposures of Ligurious slopes and on the heights of the Luberon. And while Grenouille chopped up what was to be distilled, Baldini hectically bustled about heating a brick-lined hearth, because speed was the alpha and omega of this procedure, and placed on it a copper kettle, the bottom well covered with water. He threw in the minced plants, quickly closed off the double-walled Moor's head, and connected two hoses to allow water to pass in and out. This clever mechanism for cooling the water, he explained, was something he had added on later, since out in the field, of course, one had simply used bellowed air for cooling. And then he blew on the fire. Slowly the kettle came to a boil, and after a while the distillate started to flow out of the Moor's head third tap into a Florentine flask that Baldini had set below it. At first, hesitantly, drop by drop, then in a thread-like stream. It looked rather unimpressive to begin with, like some thin, murky soup. Bit by bit, however, especially after the first flask had been replaced with a second and set aside to settle, the brew separated into two different liquids, below the floral or herbal fluid, above a thick floating layer of oil. If one carefully poured off the fluid, which had only the lightest aroma, through the lower spout of the Florentine flask, the pure oil was left behind, the essence, the heavily scented principle of the plant. Grenouille was fascinated by the process. If ever anything in his life had kindled his enthusiasm, granted not a visible enthusiasm but a hidden one, an excitement burning with a cold flame, then it was this procedure for using fire, water, steam, and a cunning apparatus to snatch the scented soul from matter. That scented soul, that ethereal oil, was in fact the best thing about matter, the only reason for his interest in it. The rest of the stupid stuff, the blossoms, leaves, rind, fruit, colour, beauty, vitality, and all those other useless qualities, were of no concern to him. They were mere husk and ballast, to be disposed of. From time to time, when the distillate had grown watery and clear, they took the alembic from the fire, opened it, and shook out the cooked muck. It looked as flabby and pale as soggy straw, like the bleached bones of little birds, like vegetables that had been boiled too long, insipid and stringy, pulpy, hardly still recognisable for what it was, disgustingly cadaverous, and almost totally robbed of its own odour. They threw it out the window into the river. Then they fed the alembic with new, fresh plants, poured in more water, and set it back on the hearth. And once again the kettle began to simmer, and again the lifeblood of the plants dripped into the Florentine flask. This often went on all night long. Baldini watched the hearth, Grenouille kept an eye on the flasks. There was nothing else to do while waiting for the next batch. They sat on footstools by the fire, under the spell of the rotund flacon, both spellbound, if for very different reasons. Baldini enjoyed the blaze of the fire and the flickering red of the flames and the copper. He loved the crackling of the burning wood, the gurgle of the alembic, for it was like the old days. You could lose yourself in it. He fetched a bottle of wine from the shop, for the heat made him thirsty, and drinking wine was like the old days too. And then he began to tell stories from the old days, endless stories, about the War of the Spanish Succession, when his own participation against the Austrians had had a decisive influence on the outcome, about the Camisard, together with whom he had haunted the Cévennes, about the daughter of a Huguenot in the Estérel, who, intoxicated by the scent of lavender, had complied with his wishes, about a forest fire that he had damn near started, and which would then have probably set the entire Provence ablaze, as sure as there was a heaven and hell, for a biting mistral had been blowing. And over he told about distilling out in the open fields at night by moonlight, accompanied by wine and the screech of cicadas, and about a lavender oil that he had created, one so refined and powerful that you could have weighed it out in silver, about his apprentice years in Genoa, about his journeyman years in the city of Grasse, where there were as many perfumers as shoemakers, some of them so rich they lived like princes, in magnificent houses, with shaded gardens and terraces and wainscoted dining rooms, where they feasted with porcelain and golden cutlery, and so on. Such were the stories Baldini told while he drank his wine, and his cheeks grew ruddy from the wine and the blazing fire, and from his own enthusiastic storytelling. Grenouille, however, who sat back more in the shadows, did not listen to him at all. He did not care about old tales. He was interested in one thing only, this new process. He stared uninterruptedly at the tube at the top of the alembic, out of which the distillate ran in a thin stream. And as he stared at it, he imagined that he himself was such an alembic, simmering away inside, just like this one, out of which there likewise gushed a distillate, but a better, a newer, an unfamiliar distillate of those exquisite plants that he tended within him, that blossomed there, their bouquet unknown to anyone but himself, and that with their unique scent he could turn the world into a fragrant Garden of Eden, where life would be relatively bearable for him, olfactorily speaking. To be a giant alembic, flooding the whole world with a distillate of his own making, that was the daydream to which Grenouille gave himself up. But while Baldini, inflamed by the wine, continued to tell ever more extravagant tales of the old days, and got more and more tangled up in his uninhibited enthusiasms, Grenouille soon abandoned his bizarre fantasy. For the moment he banished from his thoughts the notion of a giant alembic, and instead he pondered how he might make use of his newly gained knowledge for more immediate goals. 19. It wasn't long before he had become a specialist in the field of distillation. He discovered, and his nose was of more use in the discovery than Baldini's rules and regulations, that the heat of the fire played a significant role in the quality of the distillate. Every plant, every flower, every sort of wood, and every oil-yielding seed demanded a special procedure. Sometimes you had to build up the hottest head of steam, sometimes you just left it at a moderate boil, and some flowers yielded their best only if you let them steep over the lowest possible flame. It was much the same with their preparation. Mint and lavender could be distilled by the bunch. Other things needed to be carefully culled, plucked, chopped, grated, crushed, or even made into pulp before they were placed in the copper kettle. Many things simply could not be distilled at all, which irritated Grenouille no end. Having observed what a sure hand Grenouille had with the apparatus, Baldini had given him free rein with the alembic, and Grenouille had taken full advantage of that freedom. While still mixing perfumes and producing other scented and herbal products during the day, he occupied himself at night exclusively with the art of distillation. His plan was to create entirely new basic odours, and with them to produce at least some of the scents that he bore within him. At first he had some small successes. He succeeded in producing oils from nettles and from cress seeds, toilet water from the fresh bark of elderberry and from yew sprigs. These distillates were only barely similar to the odour of their ingredients, but they were at least interesting enough to be processed further. But there were also substances with which the procedure was a complete failure. Grenouille tried, for instance, to distill the odour of glass, the clayey, cool odour of smooth glass, something a normal human being cannot perceive at all. He got himself both window glass and bottle glass, and tried working with it in large pieces, in fragments, in slivers, as dust, all without the least success. He distilled brass, porcelain and leather, grain and gravel. He distilled plain dirt, blood and wood and fresh fish, his own hair. By the end he was distilling plain water, water from the Seine, the distinctive odour of which seemed to him worth preserving. He believed that with the help of an alembic he could rob these materials of their characteristic odours, just as could be done with thyme, lavender, and caraway seeds. He did not know that distillation is nothing more than a process for separating complex substances into volatile and less volatile components, and that it is only useful in the art of perfumery because the volatile essential oils of certain plants can be extracted from the rest, which have little or no scent. For substances lacking these essential oils, the distilling process is, of course, wholly pointless. For us moderns, educated in the natural sciences, that is immediately apparent. For Grenouille, however, this knowledge was won painfully after a long chain of disappointing experiments. For months on end he sat at his alembic night after night, and tried every way he could think to distill radically new scents, scents that had never existed on earth before in a concentrated form. But except for a few ridiculous plant oils, nothing came of it. From the immeasurably deep and fecund well of his imagination, he had pumped not a single drop of a real and fragrant essence, had been unable to realize a single atom of his olfactory preoccupations. When it finally became clear to him that he had failed, he halted his experiments and fell mortally ill. 20. He came down with a high fever, which for the first few days was accompanied by heavy sweats, but which later, as if the pores of his skin were no longer enough, produced countless pustules. Grenouille's body was strewn with reddish blisters. Many of them popped open, releasing their watery contents, only to fill up again. Others grew into true boils, swelling up thick and red, and then erupting like craters, spewing viscous pus and blood streaked with yellow. In time, with his hundreds of ulcerous wounds, Grenouille looked like some martyr stoned from the inside out. Naturally, Baldini was worried. It would have been very unpleasant for him to lose his precious apprentice, just at the moment when he was planning to expand his business beyond the borders of the capital and out across the whole country. For increasingly, orders for those innovative scents that Paris was so crazy about were indeed coming not only from the provinces, but also from foreign courts. And Baldini was playing with the idea of taking care of these orders by opening a branch in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, virtually a small factory, where the fastest-moving scents could be mixed in quantity and bottled in quantity in smart little flacons, packed by smart little girls, and sent off to Holland, England, and Greater Germany. Such an enterprise was not exactly legal for a master perfumer residing in Paris, but Baldini had recently gained the protection of people in high places. His exquisite scents had done that for him, not just with the commissary, but also with such important personages as the gentleman holding the franchise for the Paris Customs Office, or with a member of the Conseil Royal des Finances and promoter of flourishing commercial undertakings like Monsieur Feydeau de Brou. The latter had even held out the prospect of a royal patent, truly the best thing that one could hope for, a kind of carte blanche for circumventing all civil and professional restrictions. It meant the end of all business worries, and the guarantee of secure, permanent, unassailable prosperity. And Baldini was carrying yet another plan under his heart, his favourite plan, a sort of counterplan to the factory in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, where his wares, though not mass-produced, would be made available to anyone. But for a selected number of well-placed, highly-placed clients, he wanted to create, or rather have created, personal perfumes that would fit only their wearer, like tailored clothes, would be used only by the wearer, and would bear his or her illustrious name. He could imagine a parfum de la Marquise de Cernay, a parfum de la Maréchale de Villars, a parfum du Duc d'Aiguillon, and so on. He dreamed of a parfum de Madame la Marquise de Pompadour, even of a parfum de Sa Majesté le Roi, in a flacon of costliest cut agate with a holder of chased gold, and, hidden on the inside of the base, the engraved words, Giuseppe Baldini, Parfumeur. The king's name and his own, both on the same object. To such glorious heights had Baldini's ideas risen. And now Grenouille had fallen ill. Even though Grimal, might he rest in peace, had sworn there had never been anything wrong with him, that he could stand up to anything, had even put the Black Plague behind him. And here he had gone and fallen ill, mortally ill. What if he were to die? Dreadful! For with him would die the splendid plans for the factory, for the smart little girls, for the patent, and for the king's perfume. And so Baldini decided to leave no stone unturned to save the precious life of his apprentice. He ordered him moved from his bunk in the laboratory to a clean bed on the top floor. He had the bed made up with damask. He helped bear the patient up the narrow stairway with his own hands, despite his unutterable disgust at the pustules and festering boils. He ordered his wife to heat chicken broth and wine. He sent for the most renowned physician in the neighbourhood, a certain Procop, who demanded payment in advance, 20 francs, before he would even bother to pay a call. The doctor came, lifted up the sheet with dainty fingers, took one look at Grenouille's body, which truly looked as if it had been riddled with hundreds of bullets, and left the room without ever having opened the bag that his attendant always carried about with him. The case, so began his report to Baldini, was quite clear. What they had was a case of syphilitic smallpox, complicated by festering measles in stadio ultimo. No treatment was called for, since a lancet for bleeding could not be properly inserted into the deteriorating body, which was more like a corpse than a living organism. And although the characteristic pestilential stench associated with the illness was not yet noticeable, an amazing detail and a minor curiosity from a strictly scientific point of view, there could not be the least doubt of the patient's demise within the next 48 hours, as surely as his name was Dr. Procop. Whereupon he exacted yet another 20 francs for his visit and prognosis, 5 francs of which was repayable in the event that the cadaver, with its classic symptoms, be turned over to him for demonstration purposes, and took his leave. Baldini was beside himself. He wailed and lamented in despair. He bit his fingers, raging at his fate. Once again, just before reaching his goal, his grand, very grand plans had been thwarted. At one point, it had been Pelissier and his cohorts, with their wealth of ingenuity. Now it was this boy, with his inexhaustible store of new scents, this scruffy brat who was worth more than his weight in gold, who had decided now, of all times, to come down with syphilitic smallpox and festering measles in stadio ultimo. Now, of all times! Why not 2 years from now? Why not one? By then he could have been plundered like a silver mine, like a golden ass. He could have gone ahead and died next year.
But no, he was dying now, God damn it all, within 48 hours.
For a brief moment, Baldini considered the idea of a pilgrimage to Notre Dame, where he would light a candle and plead with the Mother of God for Grenouille's recovery. But he let the idea go, for matters were too pressing. He ran to get paper and ink, then shooed his wife out of the sick room. He was going to keep watch himself. Then he sat down in a chair next to the bed, his notepaper on his knees, the pen wet with ink in his hand, and attempted to take Grenouille's perfumatory confession. For God's sake, he dare not slip away without a word, taking along the treasures he bore inside him. Would he not, in these last hours, leave a testament behind in faithful hands, so that posterity would not be deprived of the finest sense of all time? He, Baldini, would faithfully administer that testament, the canon of formulas for the most sublime sense ever smelled, would bring them all to full bloom. He would attach undying fame to Grenouille's name. He would, yes, he swore it by everything holy, lay the best of these scents at the feet of the king, in an agate flacon with gold chasing and the engraved dedication, "From Jean-Baptiste Grenouille, Parfumeur, Paris." So spoke, or better, whispered, Baldini into Grenouille's ear, unremittingly beseeching, pleading, wheedling. But all in vain. Grenouille yielded nothing except watery secretions and bloody pus. He lay there mute in his damask, and parted with those disgusting fluids, but not with his treasures, his knowledge, not a single formula for a scent. Baldini would have loved to throttle him, to club him to death, to beat those precious secrets out of that moribund body, had there been any chance of success, and had it not so blatantly contradicted his understanding of a Christian's love for his neighbour. And so he went on purring and crooning in his sweetest tones, and coddled his patient, and, though only after a great and dreadful struggle with himself, dabbed with cooling presses the patient's sweat-drenched brow and the seething volcanoes of his wounds, and spooned wine into his mouth, hoping to bring words to his tongue, all night long and all in vain. In the grey of dawn he gave up. He fell exhausted into an armchair at the far end of the room, and stared, no longer in rage, really, but merely yielding to silent resignation, at Grenouille's small, dying body there in the bed, whom he could neither save nor rob, nor from whom he could salvage anything else for himself, whose death he could only witness numbly, like a captain watching his ship sink, taking all his wealth with it into the depths. And then, all at once, the lips of the dying boy opened, and in a voice whose clarity and firmness betrayed next to nothing of his immediate demise, he spoke. "Tell me, maître, are there other ways to extract the scent from things besides pressing or distilling?" Baldini, believing the voice had come either from his own imagination or from the next world, answered mechanically, "Yes, there are." "What are they?" came the question from the bed. And Baldini opened his tired eyes wide. Grenouille lay there, motionless, among his pillows. Had the corpse spoken? "What are they?" came the renewed question, and this time Baldini noticed Grenouille's lips move. "It's over now," he thought. "This is the end. This is the madness of fever, or the throes of death." And he stood up, went over to the bed, and bent down to the sick man. His eyes were open, and he gazed up at Baldini with the same strange lurking look that he had fixed on him at their first meeting. "What are they?" he asked. Baldini felt a pang in his heart. He could not deny a dying man his last wish, and he answered, "There are three other ways, my son. Enfleurage à chaud, enfleurage à froid, and enfleurage à l'huile. They are superior to distillation in several ways, and they are used for extraction of the finest of all scents. jasmine, rose, and orange blossom.
Where?
Asked Grenouille. In the south, answered Baldini. Above all, in the town of Grasse.
Good, said Grenouille.
And with that he closed his eyes. Baldini raised himself up slowly. He was very depressed. He gathered up his notepaper, on which he had not written a single line, and blew out the candle. Day was dawning already. He was dead tired. One ought to have sent for a priest, he thought. Then he made a hasty sign of the cross with his right hand, and left the room. Grenouille was, however, anything but dead. He was only sleeping very soundly, deep in dreams, sucking fluids back into himself. The blisters were already beginning to dry out on his skin. The craters of pus had begun to drain, the wounds to close. Within a week, he was well again. 21. He would have loved then and there to have left for the south, where he could learn the new techniques the old man had told him about. But that was, of course, out of the question. He was, after all, only an apprentice, which was to say, a nobody. Strictly speaking, as Baldini explained to him, this was after he had overcome his initial joy at Grenouille's resurrection, strictly speaking, he was less than a nobody, since a proper apprentice needed to be of faultless, that is to say, legitimate birth, to have relatives of like standing, and to have a certificate of indenture, all of which he lacked. Should he, Baldini, nevertheless decide one day to help him obtain his journeyman's papers, that would happen only on the basis of Grenouille's uncommon talents, his faultless behaviour from then on, and his, Baldini's, own infinite kindness, which though it had often worked to his own disadvantage, he would forever be incapable of denying. To be sure, it was a good while before he fulfilled his promised kindness, just a little under 3 years. During that period, and with Grenouille's help, Baldini realized his high-flying dreams. He built his factory in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, succeeded in his scheme for exclusive perfumes at court, received a royal patent. His fine fragrances were sold as far off as St. Petersburg, as Palermo, as Copenhagen. A musk-impregnated item was much sought after even in Constantinople, where God knows they already had enough scents of their own. Baldini's perfumes could be smelled both in elegant offices in the city of London and at the court in Parma, both in the royal castle at Warsaw and in the little schloss of the Graf von und zu Lippe-Detmold. Having reconciled himself to living out his old age in bitterest poverty near Messina, Baldini was now, at age 70, indisputably Europe's greatest perfumer and one of the richest citizens of Paris. Early in 1756, he had in the meantime acquired the adjoining building on the Pont au Change, using it solely as a residence, since the old building was literally stuffed full to the attic with scents and spices. He informed Grenouille that he was now willing to release him, but only on 3 conditions. First, he would not be allowed to produce in the future any of the perfumes now under Baldini's roof, nor sell their formulas to third parties. Second, he must leave Paris and not enter it again for as long as Baldini lived. And third, he was to keep the first 2 conditions absolutely secret. He was to swear to this by all the saints, by the poor soul of his mother, and on his own honour. Grenouille, who had neither any honour nor believed in any saints, or in the poor soul of his mother, swore it. He would have sworn to anything. He would have accepted any condition Baldini might propose, because he wanted those silly journeyman's papers that would make it possible for him to live an inconspicuous life, to travel undisturbed, and to find a job. Everything else was unimportant to him. What kinds of conditions were those, anyway? Not enter Paris again? What did he need Paris for? He knew it down to its last stinking cranny. He took it with him wherever he went. He had owned Paris for years now. Not produce any of Baldini's top-selling perfumes, not pass on their formulas. As if he could not invent 1,000 others, just as good and better, if and when he wanted to. But he didn't want to at all. He did not in the least intend to go into competition with Baldini or any other bourgeois perfumer. He was not out to make his fortune with his art. He didn't even want to live from it if he could find another way to make a living. He wanted to empty himself of his innermost being, of nothing less than his innermost being, which he considered more wonderful than anything else the world had to offer. And thus Baldini's conditions were no conditions at all for Grenouille. He set out in spring, early one May morning. Baldini had given him a little rucksack, a second shirt, 2 pairs of stockings, a large sausage, a horse blanket, and 25 francs. That was far more than he was obligated to do, Baldini said, considering that Grenouille had not paid a sol in fees for the profound education he had received. He was obligated to pay 2 francs in severance, nothing more. But he could no more deny his own kindly nature than he could the deep sympathy for Jean-Baptiste that had accumulated in his heart over the years. He wished him good luck in his wanderings, and once more warned him emphatically not to forget his oath. With that, he accompanied him to the servants' entrance where he had once taken him in, and let him go. He did not give him his hand. His sympathy did not reach quite that far. He had never shaken hands with him. He had always avoided so much as touching him, out of some kind of sanctimonious loathing, as if there were some danger that he could be infected or contaminated. He merely said a brief adieu, and Grenouille nodded and ducked away and was gone. The street was empty. 22. Baldini watched him go, shuffling across the bridge to the island, small, bent, bearing his rucksack like a hunchback, looking from the rear like an old man. On the far side, where the street made a dogleg at the Palais de Parlement, he lost sight of him, and felt extraordinarily relieved. He had never liked the fellow. He could finally admit it now. He had never felt comfortable the whole time he had housed him under his roof and plundered him. He felt much as would a man of spotless character who does some forbidden deed for the first time, who uses underhanded tricks when playing a game. True, the risk that people might catch up with him was small, and the prospects for success had been great. But even so, his nervousness and bad conscience were equally great. In fact, not a day had passed in all those years when he had not been haunted by the notion that in some way or other he would have to pay for having got involved with this man. If only it turns out all right, that had been his continuous anxious prayer. If only I succeed in reaping the profits of this risky adventure without having to pay the piper. If only I succeed. What I'm doing is not right, but God will wink his eye. I'm sure he will. He has punished me hard enough many times in my life, without any cause, so that it would only be just if he would deal graciously with me this time. What wrong have I actually done, if there has been a wrong? At the worst, I am operating somewhat outside guild regulations, by exploiting the wonderful gifts of an unskilled worker and passing off his talent as my own. At the worst, I have wandered a bit off the traditional path of guild virtue. At the very worst, I am doing today what I myself have condemned in the past. Is that a crime? Other people cheat their whole life long. I have only fudged a bit for a couple of years, and only because of purest chance I was given a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Perhaps it wasn't chance at all, but God himself who sent this wizard into my house, to make up for the days of humiliation by Pélissier and his cohorts. Perhaps divine providence was not directing himself at me at all, but against Pélissier. That's perfectly possible. How else would God have been able to punish Pélissier, other than by raising me up? My luck, in that case, would be the means by which divine justice has achieved its end, and thus I not only ought to accept it, but I must, without shame and without the least regret. Such had often been Baldini's thoughts during those years. Mornings, when he would descend the narrow stairway to his shop. Evenings, when he would climb back up, carrying the contents of the cash box, to count the heavy gold and silver coins. And at night, when he lay next to the snoring bag of bones that was his wife,